This is Zocalo Public Square, co-produced by KCRW. Today we're featuring a roundtable conversation that examines how a traumatic childhood can lead to physical ailments in adults. That's at least according to several new studies. Moderator Sarah Varney of KQED talks with physician Nadine Burke of the Bayview Child Health Center, Robin Carr Morse, author of Scared Sick, The Role of Childhood Trauma in Adult Disease, and Katie Albright, Executive Director of the San Francisco Child Abuse Prevention Center.
I want to start actually with you, Robin, tonight. I think the first question that many of us have on our minds is, what kind of childhood trauma are we talking about here? And when is the childhood trauma strong enough to have deleterious effects later on in a person's life?
Well, in Scared Sick, we're certainly talking primarily about childhood emotional trauma. But to separate them is a little bit ridiculous because what happens to us emotionally happens to us physically as well. So we're talking about emotional trauma that has very strong biological, physiological consequences, particularly one of the things that people need to understand is that what happens when fear comes into the brain, it upsets the entire system. It upsets the endocrine and the immune system. There's a direct connection called the HPA axis, the fight-flight system that we all know about, right? Fight-flight means that fear comes into the brain. A message is sent from the hypothalamus in the brain to the pituitary, to the adrenal system, and the whole system is now engaged. So what happens to us emotionally happens to us physically.
Dr. Burke, can you talk a little bit, though, more specifically about what kind of a home would lead to that kind of chronic stress? Describe for us a couple of the homes that perhaps you've seen in your practice in San Francisco.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, definitely a home where there is any type of domestic violence. If there's a threat to the integrity, the fear is around... The fear response is triggered when there's a threat to the integrity. So domestic violence, physical abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse, certainly. But then also for kids, something else that's a threat to the childhood integrity is separation from their parent. And so with a parent, a child's livelihood and survival being dependent on their parent. If the child is separated from the parent, such as being placed in foster care, or even honestly, like an acrimonious divorce or something like that, where the child is separated from the parent, or the parent disappearing without the child understanding why that happened. So parental incarceration is certainly one of the things that we have seen to... be a chronic stressor for kids.
And how long does the chronic stress have to be in play before we start to see these effects later on in life? Are we talking about a child who's under severe stress for 6 months perhaps, or does this have to be something that goes on for several years before the effects really get rooted into the child's system?
It's different for different kids. It's amazing. People talk a lot about resilience, and I'm very cautious of that word. But it has to do with your own DNA and how susceptible the child is initially. And then from there, it also has to do with, what the circumstances are. We've seen this before. Two siblings in the same household can have a very different response to what has happened in the household. So there's no formula for it. But certainly... the interpersonal nature has a strong effect. So the more interpersonal, for example, physical or physical abuse or domestic violence, those have a very strong correlation. The other thing is neglect, right? Which is also a very interpersonal experience of not having your needs met by your parents. So those are things that are demonstrated to make a difference. The longer it goes on, the more intense it is, things like that.
So these are not necessarily households. I mean, I have a 4.5-year-old. It's stressful. I got in a major battle with him last night about not finishing his dinner before he could have a popsicle. And there was severe stress in the home for 20 minutes. We're not talking about that.
No, in fact...
I don't need to be worried that I'm going to impair my child
Well, what's interesting about that is that although that feels quite stressful... you as a parent are actually meeting your child's needs. And you may not agree with it.
he may not agree with you.
That type of stress is, you know, as long as you don't beat him into eating his dinner, you should be fine. Yeah.
Well, Katie, you obviously work on child abuse prevention, and I'm curious if you have a sense of whether or not children feel that they can hide them. Can children hide themselves from some of these stressors? I mean, clearly, if they're being abused physically in the home, it's difficult to necessarily get away from that. But is there a way that that you've seen children react in these homes as sort of a defense mechanism?
Oh, completely. And I think when you look at the different types of stressors in the home, as Dr. Burke was mentioning, it's going to impact, and it's very variable depending on what's going on. So you look at risk factors relating to the child, risk factors relating to the parent and the family situation, and risk factors relating to the sort of entire community setting. And so for the child, there's a high correlation between increased abuse or neglect with little kids. Older boys are more susceptible to physical abuse. Hmm. Older girls, teenage girls are more susceptible to sexual abuse. And children could look very much like a parent or look very much like a partner, different from another sibling in the home, and therefore be treated very differently. And as Dr. Burke was mentioning, children develop a level of resiliency. And each child, depending on their DNA or their environmental makeup, may develop resiliencies in different ways. And there is a natural way to protect yourself. And so what we often do when working with children, and we work both with children and with caregivers, is to provide those mechanisms so when bad things happen, they have a way to be able to react in a safe way, both for parents and for the child.
And what are some of those things that you tell them to do?
Well, from a children's perspective, to be able to identify, they're not required to be their own protector, but who are the safe adults in their lives that they can go and find to help themselves? So using their voice. And for the adults to find a parent who or a caregiver or an adult in their life who would listen to them. One of the things I think we learned when we were reading over the last couple months about the Sandusky case is that oftentimes adults don't believe children. And so what we try very hard is to teach children to use their voice and for parents to listen to them.
Hmm. So, Robin, we're talking about children who are growing up in these households, and you were describing how, you know, their little bodies are essentially flooded with cortisol and adrenaline, and that this sort of constant stress is having an effect on the architecture of their brain and their nervous systems. And I wonder if you can talk more specifically about 20, 30, 40 years down the road, what actually is showing up? What do we see in a person in terms of their rates of chronic disease or other things that we could perhaps trace back?
I'd like to back up. I want to answer that question,
yeah.
But I'd like to back up just a little bit. You were talking about the kinds of things that are in the home. And we got a wonderful series of understandings about things that affect this in the home with older children. But if we're talking about a baby, it's a little different scenario. Toxic stress or trauma for a baby is very different than toxic stress or trauma for an older child or an adult. You know, we think of trauma as a big deal. It's a car accident or it's a Katrina or a natural disaster. But trauma for a baby is much subtler and it's much more invasive because that little nervous system is just beginning chemically and structurally. And so is the endocrine system, and so is the immune system. So when things happen, when bad things happen chronically, not just one thing, but chronically, particularly during gestation when mom is pregnant with that little fetus, or in the first 2 years of life, it takes a much stronger hold on the body of the individual. Things like gestating inside of a mom who is stressed herself, who's experiencing distress. When mom is distressed, the fetus is distressed. The same chemicals, cortisol and adrenaline, bathe that little brain and body, same chemicals that she is experiencing in response to her own difficulties. Being born via certain kinds of invasive procedures, the chronic use or the too often use of cesarean sections and inductions is a trauma to a tiny baby. being born prematurely. You know, preemies, we can keep preemies alive now at younger and younger ages, but they go to the NICU, the neonatal intensive care unit. Their nervous system is not ready for touch, let alone for light or sound or any of the other realities in this world. And so in the NICU, the average preemie experiences 10 to 15 painful events every day. Then going into a home where there's domestic violence or addiction or mental illness, probably the most surprising thing that I found in the research, the thing that surprised me the most about what causes trauma very early in life is maternal depression. You know, we think of it as a fairly benign situation and have great empathy, clearly and rightfully, for the mom. But what maternal depression means to an infant is that mom is not available to connect with eye contact, to connect with reciprocal cooing and joyfulness and immediacy of response. So the attachment relationship is very much interfered with by her illness. And, you know, I was amazed to find that in many studies, maternal depression has as great an impact as child abuse and neglect. Mm. Just a surprising reality. And then you have the whole host of things that you spoke about that can go on in the home. But of all the things that probably is the most critical early, it's the attachment relationship. When it's broken profoundly, whether it's by hospitalization or whatever, events take place that disable that envelope of love and connection between a baby and a parent, that's trauma to that little brain and body. And if there's any one health insurance policy that we have, it's that relationship. It's that loving relationship with one person.
And there's some pretty incontrovertible research that we've seen over the years. We were talking about a study in the green room, a study called the ACE study, that essentially linked this, that said if you have these risk factors early in your life, and essentially the higher the number of risk factors you have, the more likely you are to have heart disease.
That's right.
Stroke.
That's
right. Talk if you can about
it's interesting
that
because I mentioned the HPA axis. In fight flight, HPA axis is triggered. The two main hormones involved in fight flight are, as Sarah mentioned, adrenaline and cortisol, which affect the entire system. So that when you look down the line at what the diseases are that appear later when there's been chronic trauma early, they are diseases of the exact parts of the body that fight flight was meant to prevent or meant to care for, but actually instead undermines functions of both the immune and the endocrine system. So when you have excessive adrenaline, and again, I want to repeat, this is when we have chronic events early in the life of a child. It's never just one. But when you have chronic stimulation of adrenaline and cortisol, the diseases that appear later are diseases that are born of the dysregulation of those two hormones and their impact on the immune and endocrine system. So too much adrenaline, you see high rates of heart disease, hypertension, stroke, hardening of the arteries, high cholesterol, anxiety, panic. Too much cortisol. These two hormones are meant to act in counterpart with each other. So adrenaline is the mobilizing hormone, and cortisol is the demobilizing hormone. So the diseases that are born of excessive cortisol are mutes the immune system, are like the autoimmune diseases, diseases of inflammation. And then if things continue and the child goes from fight flight into full-blown trauma, you see both cortisol and adrenaline circulating at the same time, frozen in place, and you see diseases like fibromyalgia and GERD and IBS, diseases that have this cyclical quality to them.
So clearly, if we know that this to be the case, you'd think we'd want to prevent it in the first place, which, Dr. Burke, is some of the work that you're doing in San Francisco. I wonder if you can describe for the audience how, when a patient presents at the clinic, at the baby clinic where you have been working, and how you have this multidisciplinary team that essentially sits down and talks about what's going on in the home. Can you kind of walk us through a patient case?
What we do at the Bayview Child Health Center is you know, we were working with a very high-risk population, one of the highest rate. In the neighborhood that we serve, violence is the number one cause of premature death. And that's kind of the neighborhood that we're working in San Francisco. And so I was seeing a lot of kids in clinic who were having lots of problems with, you know, behavior and learning. A lot of kids sent to me for ADHD. And then when I looked at, when I did my job as a pediatrician and did an actual thorough history and physical exam, what I found was a lot of them were really in the spectrum of trauma, and not necessarily PTSD, because there's no post, like when you go home to it every day, there's no PTSD, but really what we're now calling more trauma spectrum disorder or developmental trauma disorder, because it goes on and it affects kids' development. And when I read about the ACEs study and saw that... you know, for these adults, those who are exposed to, you know, four or more of these categories of adverse childhood experiences, they're, compared to someone who had none of these, their risk of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease was 260%. For hepatitis, it was 2.5 times. For depression, it was 4.5 times. For suicidality, it was 12 times. For IV drug use, it was 46 times. For autoimmune disease, if you had two of these adverse childhood experiences, your risk was double as compared to someone who had none. And so as a pediatrician, I was like, wow, you know, I give the tetanus shot all day long, but I haven't treated a case of tetanus in a while. And so really prevention is the key. And what we started doing was universal screening. So we have, for every child, when they come in, you have your annual physical. And, you know, I ask about how many ounces of milk you're drinking a day. And are you potty trained or not? Or are you meeting your developmental milestones? And the other thing I ask about is, has your child ever been exposed to anything scary or traumatic? Have they ever witnessed any violence in the home or in the community? Have they ever been harmed by anyone? And I kind of go through, and, you know, not like on a checklist, but I go through with my mental checklist and do an ACEs screening on every single one of our kids, and then we do, and then we score it, right? And then I can also, so when we did this, it turned out that 12% of our kids had a score of 4 or more. Now, as a pediatrician, and that is, by the way, when the parent is telling me, and I'm a mandated reporter, right? So the parent at home is telling a person who is legally required to act on this, and of those families, 67% had at least one adverse childhood experience, 12% had 4 or more, and I can already say, just by looking at their chart, that child is twice as likely to have heart disease, 2.5 times as likely to have hepatitis, 12 times as likely to attempt suicide, 46 times as likely to be an IV drug user.
And I think that the big question has always been with this work, what do you do about it then? Because you are just one physician, you're a pediatrician in a very busy practice. So what do you do? What was the solution that you came up with at your clinic to make sure that these families were then getting some follow-up?
Well, if I had to deal with that on the daily and I didn't have a way to manage it, I would have a nervous breakdown. But fortunately, what we did, because this clinic was designed to reduce health disparities and improve outcomes for families in this community, we had a case manager, it's like a social worker. We had a psychologist on staff, and this was all provided through grant funding. We had an insurance counselor, because a lot of our families are so disorganized that they, you know, they lapse out of their insurance and don't renew, and then they don't want to come back to the clinic because they don't have insurance. So just making sure that folks have access, and then I could literally say, wow, that sounds like a lot. You know what? I have a colleague right down the hall who really might be able to help you with some of the behavior your child has been having ever since they witnessed X, Y, and Z happening at home. And I can also say, what's very interesting, because many of our families recognize that this is the truth, right? Like if I say, you know what, we understand now that this actually is harmful to your child's health and increases their risk of having harmful outcomes in adulthood. And we have resources to help you manage that. Mm-hmm. And I can just walk them down the hall. So we have a multidisciplinary team, and that's how we manage it in our clinic. And we meet once a week, and we have rounds, and we just talk about all the cases and make sure families are plugged into the right resources. Mm.
And Katie, in the work that you've been doing with child abuse prevention, this seems like an unusual foray into sort of bringing together child abuse prevention, a medical team, psychiatrists, social workers. Is this something that you've seen before in the kind of work that you've been doing? It always seems like child abuse is always about, you know, prosecuting the perpetrators.
So one of the things we're doing in San Francisco is really taking a healthcare lens on a public health problem, in this case, child abuse. And you could do this for any public healthcare problem, but we've really thought about taking the population of children and providing a titration or a dosage level of services depending on various children's needs. So swine flu is an example that I understand because it was happening a couple years ago, and we were hearing on the news so much about swine flu and how to do a public health care and a prevention model on swine flu. And so one of the things we were hearing on the radio quite a lot is everyone should make sure you cough into your elbow and wash your hands, and that was going to help decrease a massive spread of swine flu. The analogy in the child abuse prevention world is to really talk about parenting and appropriate parenting and positive disciplinary parenting, and assume, because we all are, that all children are at risk for abuse and neglect. All children are at risk of adverse childhood experiences. And so having the general awareness is very important. Then we look at the level that really Dr. Burke is very focused on, is looking at secondary prevention. This is looking at the risk factors related to child abuse. In this, took the analogy with the swine flu. You wanted to make sure that young children and pregnant moms were really getting much more intensive work, and maybe that they were actually going in and getting a swine flu shot, because that's how the community wanted to think about titrating its resources. In this realm, with child abuse prevention, we're really looking at what are the risk factors and making sure that we can identify those kids and those families that have some higher level of risk factor and being able to provide those scarce resources to them. And then you think about the tertiary prevention, and the tertiary prevention is the area we know in the community those families, those children actually are at risk. They actually have swine flu in this example, and you want to make sure that you get hospitalization, you get immediate intervention and immediate treatment for that. In the child abuse prevention analogy, in our world, it's actually kids who have a substantiated case of abuse or neglect, and you want to make sure you provide intervention services and do it in a multidisciplinary way, so all the people who need to be all around the room are able to provide the appropriate care and treatment for the child. What's interesting about the model that Dr. Burke and I are working on together is to put the pediatric hub right in the same place where the acute care, the tertiary prevention work is going on, so that we're able to do the entire spectrum of the prevention work. And it is an innovative model. It's a model that the child abuse world, child abuse prevention world, has not had this lens on it, because it really has come up from a prosecutorial standpoint. And having the healthcare lens is so essential, so important, because as we now have heard, it's not just It is both the marriage of the physical and the social emotional side, and as we also know, it also deeply involves and interacts with the education components, because it has not only long term health health implications, but it also has significant education impacts, because children often who are traumatized have different educational needs that they may need in the school.
Mm. And it seems like with this whole discussion, there's some serious implications for our class-based society. I mean, we know that people who live in South Los Angeles have very different health outcomes than those that live on the West Side, or those that live in the Oakland Hills versus the Flats. And I'm curious, you know, just yesterday we had the leading contender for the Republican presidential candidacy say, you know, I think I'm not getting this exactly right, but he said, I'm not worried about Mitt Romney. I'm not worried about poor people. There's a safety net for those people, which has caused a big discussion about how well he knows how well that safety net is functioning right now. But Robin, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what policies you might advocate for, given that that we know that poor families are particularly stressed. What are some of the policies that either you advocate for in your book or just personally to try and really get at this problem head on?
I'd like to talk about policies, but I want to back up one step and sure. say that childhood trauma is not limited to child abuse, neglect, and it's not limited to the poor.
Sure.
And the outcomes, the illness outcomes, are not limited to just people who have undergone child abuse, neglect. It's unfortunately across all class and ethnic lines. So that's something to keep in mind. I mean, death of a parent, many things that happen to everyday people also are traumatic and also are correlative to disease outcomes later in life, particularly if they happen chronically. But in terms of creating that safety net at the front end, you know, our country operates, just imagine that we in this room, all of us, were part of a big corporation, and every bit of money that we had, all of our resources individually and as families, came from the output of our corporation, our manufacturing company. And suppose what we were manufacturing was, I don't know, widgets, let's just call them widgets. And, you know, that was what we did. Would we turn our back on the quality of raw materials going into the making of our widgets? Would we absolutely ignore quality control in the assembly process and then be shocked at a high rate of return or failure of those widgets? But that's what's going on with our nation in terms of the absolute lack of a safety net at the front end. We could have a very different situation in our country. We could have every junior and senior in high school getting an opportunity to know something about relationships, what sustains them, the kind of work that goes into them, something about babies. I mean, having those, I ran a program in Oregon in 90 high schools where we put kids into a highly relational, mental health-based program 3 days a week, and 2 days a week they were in child care centers working with the reality of little kids. No better birth control program that you can come up with. I think that prenatal care obviously has to be beefed up so that we are talking about some of the things that you're talking about after the fact, before that baby ever arrives, particularly maternal emotional health and what is going on for her in the home while she's pregnant. And certainly educating young men about the importance of their role in this equation is critical. After, you know, you were talking about going to various countries and seeing in the Scandinavian countries and in France the remarkable program they have for family leave after a baby comes into the world, so there's an opportunity for that family to gel, for attachment to take place, for that family to have an opportunity together without having time constantly broken, particularly between a primary caregiver and a baby. So adequate family leave would make a great deal of difference. And I think that, you know, it's certainly true in our country that child care has lagged way behind the need for high quality care. So we have more than 50% of mommies working, of mommies of little kids, and we have very inadequate care all over the country. We have some wonderful centers, but overall those centers don't pay well, and so there's high turnover. And there's a big price in that turnover for very young children. So establishing high-quality child care. And finally, my dream is something that I've referred to as the Parenting Institute, which would be mean that if you have a child, there, you know, imagine that as easily as you could schedule a haircut or a workout, you could stop someplace on your beaten path in the mall or wherever it is and sit down and meet for 45 minutes with someone who really knew something about emotional development, how the brain works, how the body works, something about positive discipline, could sit down with them. And whatever your problem was, maybe it's a screaming, you know, a child who's just come home from school in the sixth grade and all of a sudden is miserable, doesn't want to go to school because she says she's fat, or maybe it's a two-year-old that's, you know, having temper tantrum. Doesn't matter. There's no one size fits all. It's tailored to that individual family. And people of all denominations come to the Parenting Institute because it's a cool thing to do. It doesn't look like a social service agency. It looks more like a Starbucks or a gallery. It's fun to come, and everybody goes. I mean, why should we not scaffold and support people for doing the right thing rather than, you know, they could get college credit, high school credit for attending a series of sessions. Preventive sessions with a baby would earn a tax credit. Why should we not? So those are some of the things I would...
Yeah, I was saying earlier, last year, NPR did a whole series on maternal and child health around the world, and I drew the very lucky card and got to go to France. Others went to Zimbabwe and other places. But so I was there for several weeks looking at their maternal and child health system, which they've had in place since after World War II. And it is very different. They do have these preventive health centers that are mandated by law. They're in every town practically in France. They're not perfect, and they are under immense financial pressures right now. But these are places where parents come essentially to learn how to be parents, learn how to breastfeed. And I'm curious, Dr. Burke, when you were, you know, going through medical school as a when you were starting to become a pediatrician, were you taught to help parents how to parent? Or were you really just sort of looking at it?
No, of course not. No,
that seems like
not.
A big part of your job now, given what we've just been talking about.
It is. It is a very, very big part of my job right now. And we were definitely did not learn very much about that in medical school. I mean, as a pediatrician in doing residency, we got a tiny bit more of that. But really, what you get trained on is... mostly hospital-based. I mean, we spend a lot of time in the intensive care unit, and a lot of this stuff are things that you learn in practice and you learn on your own. I do want to go back to one thing that you mentioned earlier around the issue of higher income versus lower income folks. One of the things, you know, we've been talking about this adverse childhood experiences study. That was one study. There's been, tons of, lots of other research done since then. But the thing that I love about this study is that it was done in a population of about 17,500 people. So it's a lot of people in Kaiser San Diego. Their population was 75% Caucasian, 75% college educated. More than, I think, 93% had completed high school. So that was a population where we're not talking about a very low-income population. We're talking about a fairly middle-class population. Mm-hmm. The other interesting thing, and that population also reported, of adults, reported 12.6% of this population had four or more of these adverse childhood experiences, and about 60-something percent had at least one. What was interesting about it was when you looked at the relationship between these early traumas and heart disease and lung disease, what they found was that even if you took out the effect of high-risk behavior, so let's say even if you didn't... even if you didn't smoke or engage in any high-risk behavior, you still had an increased risk of having heart disease or lung disease because of the changes that happen in the body, the brain and the body that we were hearing about before, and the changes to your epigenetic regulation, how your DNA is transcribed, and the changes to your immune system and things like that. So I think that in terms of how we're looking at this challenge, it's really important for us to recognize that it's an issue for everyone.
Yes.
It's not just an issue for people who then go on to, drink or have, engage in high-risk behavior, high-risk sexual behavior. It's not just an issue for people who have mental health problems.
Sure.
It's an issue for everyone.
Mm. But you were talking about the neighborhood that you work in. I mean,
yeah.
You're talking about a vast majority of children who have been exposed to violence, not necessarily in the home, but outside of the home. So it is true that violence is concentrated in our
I did not mean to. You're not wrong. Okay. The exposure among the families that we see is epidemic. I mean, it's extraordinary. It's very, very intense exposure. Very, very high risk of domestic and community violence. And also higher risk of, for example, mental illness. If you have mental illness and you're having a hard time keeping down a job, chances are that you're not going to end up in living in a neighborhood where a house costs $1 million. Yeah. You're going to live in the neighborhood that I serve because you're living off a disability,
sure.
You know? And so that's, yeah.
Well, and it's equally important to realize that, you know, if you're going to fix the problem, you were talking about social policy. We've tried all kinds of targeted programs. People don't want to come. They don't want to be identified as being somehow more at risk. That's very, very tough. Even with a wonderful program like Nurse Family Partnership, which is growing around the country and is really the gold standard in terms of preventing many of these problems early in life with
high-risk
families.
Maybe just describe what Nurse Family
Nurse Family Partnership is a program that was put together by a guy named David Oles out of Colorado. Basically is a program in most states now, at least embryonically, and further, it's gone further in some states. But it does look primarily at at-risk families, but it provides a nurse as sort of a mentor that goes into the home, similar to the idea that once took place in Great Britain routinely, where a nurse came to the front door when you had your baby. These people, the nurses in Nurse Family Partnership get involved prenatally, and they reduce the number of cigarettes smoked and reduce a lot of problems that can happen during pregnancy that will affect the fetus. And then they're there through the child's second year as needed. But even that program, which is a fabulous program, has had great difficulty with being let in and maintaining a relationship with people because they feel targeted and discriminated in a negative way. So that's why the Parenting Institute, or something that is a universally available and very upbeat, positive association kind of opportunity, I think, is important to have available.
Well, a similar program that really is universal is going into the home and nurse practitioners very early on, within the first 7 to 8 weeks of a child being born, will go into everyone's home. I actually had a nurse come into my home when my son was about 11 years ago, 12 years ago now. And it is a universal approach. And just very basic things are taught around how to parent, how to feed, and how to cope in the middle of the night when your child won't go to sleep and you're pulling your hair out. And those kind of universal approaches, just in the same way we've seen those kind of approaches with education, really have much more of an impact. And so when you're thinking about public policy change, it is actually across all zip codes. We can document it across all zip codes where this is coming, all socioeconomic, all ethnicities, all cultures. And so the public policy approach really needs to be that. So it doesn't just fall on a certain group of people because we are all coping with the trauma and the long-term impacts of what that trauma is like.
This event and podcast is made possible by a grant from the California Healthcare Foundation.